What's going on over at Faku?
Are there like 1 week left? Care to share some of your favorites? Oh, I added that new one to He Tired, by the way. It was good. The one you told me to read.
I said it was good. I thought you'd like it. Welcome to episode 4 of Active Heart.
It's very weird to think that we're more than halfway through the series, the whole series. Just 6 episodes.
Go ahead.
No, you go, Paul.
Well, so first of all, like, because of you've watched the episode preview, if you watched the episode preview for the previous episode, you know that, or at the previous episode, you know that this is the episode where the Gunbuster, the titular Gunbuster, finally shows up. And it's almost like kaiju movie-esque, like Godzilla-esque, and yeah. Its refusal to show the mech for the first half. Literally, I mean, more than half, because you're expecting it to show up, but it doesn't show up until like 2/3 of the way through the episode.
Yeah. I'm about to talk about Godzilla for a different reason.
Yeah, but so that's interesting, Molly.
So the very first scene of this episode is the Exelion higher-ups having a strategy meeting about what they've discovered about the biology and the mating and the aim, as far as they can ever figure out what kind of aim,
right,
of the space monsters.
Yes.
And I think Paul and I both immediately wrote, like, Sele-ass meeting.
Yes, it's very Sele-ass. Sele being, like, the shadowy organization overseeing the Evangelion project in Eva.
Where it has that sort of imposing, like, dark room, except for everyone sitting around it in a weird,
like, circle. Dark room, but with, like, really harsh, bright white backlighting, you know, old men kind of hunched over microphones.
But then something reminded me of Shin Godzilla.
The recent Godzilla movie also directed by Anno.
And I would recommend you see this if you haven't. It's a fantastic movie.
Oh, yeah, it rules. It's excellent.
And a big theme in that movie is just bureaucracy.
Yes.
And this meeting kind of immediately reminded me less of Sele and more of Shin Godzilla, because it does then humanize these bureaucrats.
Yes.
And in, like, this is maybe 10 seconds,
mm-hmm,
where it has a quick montage of the people in the meeting, and the Exelion captain is, like, tapping his pen. And
yeah,
I don't know. I really liked this moment.
Okay.
Because it was just very much like, these are the people making decisions on behalf of all mankind.
Yeah.
And they also get bored and tap their pens.
And basically one dude is delivering the bad news, which is the space monsters are not heading for the sun, as was previously supposed, because they use stars to reproduce. The aliens are heading for Earth, and their goal, based on their movements, as near as the best minds humanity has to offer can surmise, is the destruction of humanity. And this guy delivering this news seems like
kind of weird. A bummer.
He seems like weirdly into it and like smug that he's figured it out. And also his character design looks very like character out of Akira.
Oh, yeah.
He looked very Katsuhiro Otomo. I don't know if that was a deliberate call out or if he's supposed to like look like somebody in particular, but it's just this really like Otomo looking ass guy who's like, the aliens are heading for Earth.
And he makes the salient but extremely unpleasant point that on a cosmic scale, like, maybe humans aren't really serving a purpose.
Yeah. Although, I mean, the immediate response to that is, okay, but so what purpose do the space monsters serve? Like, what purpose does life ultimately serve on a cosmic scale? Yeah. But that's, you know, it's a very nihilistic point that he makes. And the immediate concern is the fleet trying to figure out how it can return to Earth without tipping the space monsters off as to Earth's precise location.
Right.
So they're going to try and do this via this tricky warp maneuver. And meanwhile,
Meanwhile, all of the girls are showering.
Meanwhile, all of the girls are showering.
And talking about eating Andromeda cakes.
Andromeda yaki, which have been referred to in the, or have been alluded to in the childish closing, shoujo manga closing theme that we've seen so far. Although, notably, this episode, cold open, and there's no opening theme.
Yeah.
The opening theme does not roll.
Maybe this is me being hypersensitive to kind of old school shoujo stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that to be a tiny shoujo-esque moment.
Which one?
Because it reminded me of in shoujo works where high school girls are always like, let's go to the, you know, the stylish Western style cafe and
eat, oh, like, yeah.
Napoleon.
Yes, everyone, like the fixation on like everyone, you got to go get the stylish dessert or whatever. That's clearly Andromeda yaki.
And
no, although Andromeda yaki, like, is that like okonomiyaki or yakisoba? Like, maybe it's not a dessert.
No, but it could be like taiyaki.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. It's probably, I mean, the way it's talked about, it sounds like it must be a dessert, but
I think it's like a taiyaki.
Yeah.
Which are the little fish pastries.
Right. But maybe it's shaped like a galaxy.
What is a galaxy shaped like?
Well, galaxies come in many shapes and sizes. There are classic spiral galaxies like the Milky Way and indeed the Andromeda Galaxy. And then there are barred spirals and sparse spirals and globular clusters and irregular galaxies.
When did this become more attractive than this?
Oh my god.
Anyway, Noriko comes into the locker room and she is still extremely down because in the last episode, as you remember, her first love died very suddenly in a really traumatic way. And also, Amano has broken up with her.
Yes.
As her partner. And you can tell she's trying to hold it together and still be like one of the girls, but she just can't quite keep up the facade.
Right.
And Amano and young Freud are off to their own, off in their own space.
Right. And they have those two have a conversation about the special training that Noriko is receiving from Coach. And
oh, and the other girls are also gossiping.
Yes.
About like, oh, is Noriko gonna go on a date again with the coach?
TK Putty. No.
Our cat did indeed get out of the box.
Yeah, he's gonna cause trouble. Anyway.
This reminded me of episode one, where Noriko trains so hard with the coach.
Yeah.
And then when she's selected for the space program, her classmates just go like, oh, well, she's getting special treatment from the coach, so of course she did.
Right.
But Amano is really irritated by the gossip and by young Freud kind of playing into this gossip.
Yeah.
And it's another hint that, like, she has feelings for the coach.
Yes. Yeah. Again, like, more allusion. That's, like, a solid one allusion per episode thus far to Amano and Coach having some kind of situation, or at least Amano having some kind of feelings for Coach.
Yeah. Before we talk about like what's actually happening in the show, the next shot is just Noriko riding the automatic space walkway past the Exelion indoor beach.
Yes, which is just like, it's just like a metal room with like a sky and clouds painted on the walls.
But young Freud is lounging in an incredible, like, underboob bikini.
Yeah, she is out there in a hell of a skimpy bikini.
Then we get another training montage. Well, it's not quite a training montage.
Well, we just see her and Coach training, and she's training. She's training at what looks like a mech that's similar to the one she's been in before, although it has a very different cockpit. It's got this kind of like, you know, she's surrounded by like a globe of displays that show the space all around her. And she's kind of harnessed in this frame that follows her movements, so she can control it in a much more natural way.
Yeah.
And she's just running combat drills, and she seems to be getting pretty good, but coach is, you know, drilling her really hard. But she's also really into it. Like, she's clearly giving this training absolutely everything that she has.
Yeah. But young Freud is lurking and sees this training.
Right.
And it makes her really angry.
Yeah, it brings out her old competitive side.
I think this is a little... I found her in this episode to be a little more than what we've seen before.
I agree. Well, like, she feels more Asuka-ish to me here than she has felt at all thus far. Go ahead.
I'm giving Paul a look because I want to know. Right after this training scene,
yeah,
she runs into young Freud on the train platform.
Yes.
Like, did this scene remind you of the Rey and Asuka elevator confrontation?
Oh, that didn't come to mind, but I think you're onto something.
And Noriko is, to be clear, nothing like Rei Ayanami.
No, not at all.
But young Freud is sort of being Asuka-ish in this scene.
Yeah.
And that she's mad. Her emotions are really high, and she clearly, like, wants to elicit a strong emotional reaction from her sort of one-sided competitor in this case. And she challenges Noriko to a duel. And I did feel maybe not sympathetic to young Freud, but I feel like I was seeing a vulnerable side of her here.
She's more vulnerable than we've seen her at all before. It seems like what really sticks in her craw is, like, what's so special about you?
I think it's not just that, but she sort of couches all her conversations with Amano and Noriko in a, like, your coach's hot way.
Yeah.
But you also have to think about, she came to the Excellion completely alone, as far as we know.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if a big part of it is that she's just jealous that, like, they have mentorship.
Yes.
And she doesn't. That's a good point.
But she essentially bullies Noriko into going out and having a duel with her. And Noriko says, okay, fine, I'll do it.
And it's much like this is, you know, the second time that she's challenged someone to an impromptu duel, but it does seem more bullyish. It's Noriko is more cornered than Amano was. Then they are literally on an elevator in their mechs.
Yes. And as soon as they get into space, Noriko has a panic attack.
Yeah.
And can't fight. And it is clear that, like, for all, you know, for however much time she has spent training, which we get the feeling that it can't be more than a, you know, a couple of weeks at this point, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe less than that. She's not over her trauma about Smith. She's not over her failure as a combat pilot at all.
This is another really striking example of how the point of view often switches from inside the cockpit to outside the mechs. So we're seeing Noriko, like, collapse in despair, but through the movements of her robot, kind of like supplicating Freud's mech.
And
to young Freud's credit, she, I feel like, immediately kind of understands.
Yeah, she calls it off immediately. Like, she doesn't try to use it to score points on Noriko. She doesn't rat her out, except insofar as she has to then, like, presumably escort her to the infirmary, which is where the next scene takes place, I believe.
Yeah.
So, again, Young clearly not a bad person, or using this in a, you know, really slimily opportunistic way, but
no, I think she just isn't used to that. Like, isn't used to dealing with people who don't
who emote like that. Yeah.
Even though we talked a couple episodes ago about how she is emotional in a way that is uncomfortable to Noriko and Amano.
But right, she's but her not, emoting yeah. is only a different kind of control for her. Like her that whole performance she gave in the baths felt very calculated in its way.
Yeah.
And then, something else that noticed, I just want to say before this, right before the battle scene in Noriko's monologue, when she's talking about like, in her monologue, when she's thinking about what her goals for this battle are, this duel is, she says the word gunbuster aloud for the first time.
Yeah. And right before that happened, I was wondering, like, is she doing this training regimen with Coach? Like still in the dark,
right? Like it's not clear. It is not clear what she knows about Gunbuster at this point. But at this point, you know, she says this, and it's clear that she at least knows what it is. But it's very interesting. Like the question of who knows about Gunbuster is never really answered, because it seems like it's probably been a secret project.
Yeah.
But Amano clearly knows about it.
Yeah.
Noriko seems to maybe not have known about it until she started special training with Coach.
Until she just barged right into the room where it was being
kept. Yes. And then there's, and does young Freud know about it? Like,
I think no.
Reading between the lines, maybe she doesn't know, but you feel like she knows there's something.
Yeah.
And like, you know, of course, my headcanon, as the kids say for this, would be that having been raised in the Soviet bureaucracy, I feel like she would have a very finely honed sense for when something is being institutionally kept from her.
Yeah.
And I'll bet that she knows. If she doesn't know about Gunbuster's existence at this point, she's essentially inferred it from the empty space that it takes up in the structure.
That's a really well put. But then we have basically two confrontation scenes right after another, and they're both really interesting because they're both extremely different.
Yes.
The first one is after Noriko has been put in the infirmary, and she is, to everyone else's knowledge, like passed out
right
on the bed. Amano comes in, and Amano and young Freud have a 90s girl slap fight, which is like one of my 80s, sorry. Old school anime girl slap fight, which is a trope that I love, which I probably shouldn't love. But and Noriko's overhearing this, and she just overhears these slaps.
Yeah.
But it's another, like,
yet again, Noriko overhears a conversation she's not supposed to overhear.
It's also like poor, like, I feel for Amano at this point, because she's basically having the same fight with people over and over again.
Yes.
She's kind of verbally just like shaking them by the shoulders and going like, what the fuck are you doing with Noriko?
Yeah.
She's going to get herself killed.
Yes.
Stop.
Yeah.
But we've never seen her be physical.
No.
With someone. So this is really interesting.
And what does young Freud say that makes her haul off and slap her?
God, now I don't remember.
Is it something about Coach?
I don't know.
Man, this is a big failure. Oh, well.
It might be that Noriko just hears the slap.
No. We hear the whole conversation. Like, young Freud crosses a line.
Yeah. I'm sorry that we don't remember exactly what caused this slap. But
I could go check.
I'll talk for a minute and you can check.
Well, no. We'll just put a little edit in here. Okay, so the reason that Amano hauls off and slaps young Freud is that young Freud says, I just wanted to duel her, but I guess I didn't have to. And Noriko, Amano is so incensed at this that she slaps young Freud. Young Freud slaps her right back.
Okay.
And then they have, that's a whole,
It's interesting because I don't actually feel like young Freud has a cavalier personality, you know?
No.
But there's something about the way she talks with Amano when they're not in combat, where at least at this point in the story, she just kind of can't let down this facade, if it is a facade of like
kind of blasé, devil may care-ishness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now I remember, because we laughed at this while we were watching it.
Yes.
The translation is something like, what? I just wanted to duel in space.
Yeah, but I mean, it was a very literal translation of like, why did you do that? And young friend's like, what? I just wanted to have a duel with her in space. It's great.
But the next scene is a super different confrontation, not only from the scene before it, but from similar setups that we've seen up to this point.
Yes.
Yet
again, Amano goes to confront Coach about his decision to train Noriko, but Coach is
playing Go by himself.
Coach is playing Go by himself in a like Japanese style room with like shoji doors and tatami floors and like just the whole nine yards, and he's in there playing Go against himself. It's not clear if maybe it's like if it's against himself or if it's like a computer opponent. We do get one shot from below the Go board, like looking up through the grid, which is very Hikaru no Go for what it's worth. It's not clear, but like while he sits there like in his like yukata,
yeah,
playing Go, Amano argues with him about his decision to continue to train Noriko.
And like we've had this conversation I think two times before in the series, and every other time it's just Amano standing face to face with him,
yeah,
and getting really as angry as she gets.
Yes.
But here she is sitting on a cushion by the door. And with this Japanese style room, it's almost like another thing out of an old samurai film where it's like a samurai coming like to make a humble request of his lord.
Yeah.
Kind of like physical distance between her and Coach. And she's also like turning her head away from him. It's just very, I'm still thinking about exactly like what the show was trying to say.
The blocking of this scene is really interesting.
I wonder if it's that like, if it's to emphasize just how seriously Amano is taking this.
Yeah.
But she has this conversation and Coach says, is there anything else you want to say? And I kind of took this to be another hint at like they're maybe developing romance.
Yeah.
Which is like, which again, like nothing textual has happened.
Yeah, at
between
all.
Them.
No.
And Amano says, you can't put spilled milk back in the glass. And Coach says, when you do spill milk, just pour some more.
The Japanese says water. And I think the subtitles were essentially adapting the phrase, there's no sense crying over spilled milk. It's like, so Amano was like, you can't unspill water. And the coach is like, yeah, just pour some more water.
Oh, I'm forgetting something.
Yes.
This is another scene that tells us that Amano is like pretty in on the Gunbuster.
Yes.
Because she says, like, just use me. Just use me for your revenge.
Yes.
Against
and
the space monster.
She has a very weird way of phrasing it. Like, just use me as your tool of revenge against the space monsters. Why are you involving her in this? this whole conversation is very fraught, more so than even it has been in the past, and like hints at like a deeper and more conflicted relationship between these two characters than we've seen previously.
Yeah, because Anna's always come to confront him basically as an equal.
Yeah.
And she's sort of played up her imperiousness. Yeah. But there's something both like more tense and more intimate, yes, about this definitely conversation.
The space that she's, like the space that the conversation is set in is a more intimate space. It's a home space instead of a professional space.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's another hint, is it's like, well, she knows about this pajama go room.
It's the coach's rumpus room. It's my rumpus room. Got a go board, some shoji doors.
Then we cut to the...
It's where me and the boys just listen to some haiku.
Let's get some basho.
Just get some basho going. Go on.
Okay. Now the crew is actually implementing their warp, right, sequence.
And we're told that when they're in subspace, they can't be intercepted by the enemy or tracked by the enemy. And the whole returning home plan is predicated on the space monsters can't find us and can't attack us in subspace. This turns out to be an unfounded assumption, as the space monsters do find them.
Also,
yes,
time dilation again.
Yes.
The captain announces, like, when we reach Earth, it will be 2032.
Right.
And good news, we're going to get there right before Halley's Comet happens. Yes. And interestingly, the students don't seem to care. Like, they cheer about Halley's Comet, and then there's a couple comments like, oh, I want to go shopping when I get back, but it's, I mean, not the way I would feel.
It's something like, it's like several years of time dilation at this point. Like, you know,
it was,
it's
2023, like, yeah, when they left Earth. Yeah. So
even if they've been out for a year, which maybe, but
it's like all of their friends in school will be solidly adult.
Yeah.
When they get back.
Yeah. But
they don't seem to be too bothered. And no. I wonder if it's just that, like, the kids that made it to the Excellion are such an in-group.
Right. Like, all of our friends are here.
Yeah. And they're getting ready to go into subspace. They're counting down. The ship is going dark.
There's a bunch of really great, like, reactor animation, which I love.
There's a shot of the dorm, and Amano is reading No Longer Human.
By Osamu Dazai. Dazai. Osamu Dazai. Not Osamu Dazai. Dazai. That's funny. A great work of Japanese literature.
And I guess maybe it's interesting that she's reading that and not an academic test. Maybe she feels like she's at the point where nothing is to be gained from just reading textbooks, yeah, instead of whatever she wants to. In contrast, Noriko has a fashion magazine on her bed, which I thought was pretty moe.
Yeah, that's cute.
But in this montage of the Excellion going into subspace and everything going quiet, there is a very shocking sudden explosion.
Right.
Which is not supposed to happen. And I do love that the part of the ship they showed exploding is the snack room.
Oh,
like the snack machine waiting area.
Right, right.
Cohen Smith had their conversation about, yeah, becoming partners.
That's really great. Like the symbolic destruction of like this last sort of refuge of normalcy. So the space monsters, it turns out, can enter and attack in subspace, and they intercept the fleet. And there's this great, really scary reveal where they're trying to figure out, like, how much of our fleet is left.
Oh yeah.
Like how many of the other, like, what, you know, where is the fleet? Like how many enemies have attacked us? And initially they say most of our fleet is here. And then there's a couple seconds of confusion, and then the kind of surrounding area clears a bit, and they realize, no, it's just us and 11 ships, and literally everything else is an enemy ship. Like, they are completely boned in terms of numbers.
Yeah.
Like, in a single strike, the space monsters have nearly wiped out the entire fleet.
And everything left is just really... I mean, aside from the Exelion, it's just really small vessels.
Yeah, it's like very small support vessels. So like, it's very, very bad news. And then they are forced out of subspace early, despite trying not to be, which will reveal the position of Earth to the space monsters.
And this battle is the first time that we actually see like a live, full space monster bodies.
Yes.
Alive.
And attacking, like, engaging the ships.
And they are very scary.
Yeah.
I think they would have been scary anyway, but the story really did brilliant work in the slow reveal.
Right.
Of just parts of them.
Yeah.
Leading up to this.
They're big sort of insectoid creatures of varying sizes.
And they have kind of like a Venus flytrap.
Yeah.
Like maw.
Yeah, well, there's like, I mean, depending on, like, some of them are more plant-like, and some of them are more insect-like, or sort of some of them seem kind of fungal.
Yeah.
And, you know, fungus is inherently creepy.
It really is.
No, it really is.
I actually think fungal is like the best way to think of them if we have to make sense of them.
Yeah, no, I think that's very apt.
They mobilize the top squadron.
But notably, Linda, a random pilot, gets subbed in for Noriko, and the coach holds Noriko back and doesn't let her go out.
Yeah. And Noriko's she's like heartbroken and upset that she's being held back.
Yeah.
But she's also, as we've seen, still really terrified of space.
Yeah.
And she slinks back to her bunk, and you just get the sense that at this point she's utterly, like, she just feels guilty for existing.
Yes.
She kind of has survivor's guilt about everything.
Yeah.
And then in the battle, that's kind of, we're cutting between Noriko reflecting in her bunk and the battle happening. In the battle, we also learn that the full force of the Exelion's torpedoes do nothing
to the space monster. There's a big sequence where I love this mechanical animation. The Exelion launches a volley of photon torpedoes, and they all converge on the main sort of mothership of the space monsters and explode around it, and they're like, yes! And then, like, the explosion fades, and it's basically undamaged, and they're like, that's not great. the battle is going very poorly. And then the captain gets a notice that, like, you know, launch tube number 7 is opening, and he's like, what? And it's the gunbuster launching. So some point between Noriko being really sad and crying in her bunk and cutting to the battle scene outside, she has gotten her shit together, gone to the gunbuster, gotten into it, powered it up, and is now launching.
Okay, well, two things that are important, that I think are important, happen.
Go on.
Between that time.
All right, well, let's hear it.
The pilot who went out in Noriko's normal combat mech is killed.
Oh, yes, that's true. That does happen.
And then Noriko puts Smith's headband on.
Yes.
His, like, Hachimaki.
Yes.
Which is also what in their subspace dare in the middle of the night.
Right.
They had to tie up around
the ladder. I had the very inappropriate thought when Linda buys it. And they're like, Linda, Linda. I was like, Linda, 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 Linda. Sorry.
I was thinking it too.
That's great.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Mine's meld.
Oh, well.
Me and Paul are very drift compatible, I think.
Yes, unfortunately.
So this reminded me of, I'm going here again, episode 19, I think, of Evangelion is they're in one of many kind of like last ditch scene. A good thing about Evangelion is every single battle seems kind of last ditch.
Yes.
But this one is especially harrowing, and Shinji, the protagonist, is in, like Noriko, just like an utterly mentally, emotionally defeated place. But when these two characters realize what's at stake and they kind of have a role that no one else has, they step up, and Shinji has some line where he marches into Nerve headquarters and is like, "I am Shinji Ikari, pilot of Evangelion Unit 1. And that's how I feel about Noriko, who I guess just hopped in the
Although she doesn't
No, she just gets in.
She doesn't report for duty. She just like hops in and goes out. And this is when we get the OP.
And not quite.
No, it is.
No, not quite. Not quite.
Yeah, it is. Okay.
This is when we get the orchestral leitmotif of Gunbuster.
I take it back. You're so right. I'm completely wrong. Yeah, there's that. We hear like the Gunbuster. Like there's this great with kettle drums and low brass dun 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 dun.
Yeah.
Bum 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 bum. It's great.
And this mech just rises.
Rises up. Arms fucking crossed.
Yeah.
And it's
very cool.
It's gigantic. It's enormous. Like it's like 10 times the size of the other mechs. It's huge.
It also has kind of, as part of its like facial design,
yeah,
it has the insignia of the Excelion, like the same symbol that like the captain has on his
back. Yeah, it's like the symbol of the military branch that they're part of,
which has for us like come to be known as the symbol of Gunbuster.
Yeah,
but at first I was wondering, like, did Coach come get her
and tell
She just got in herself, because then the captain flashes on her screen. He's like, "What are you doing?
Get back here!"
And then Coach gets on and he's like, "Yeah,
yeah." Coach is like, "Go for it."
But the Gunbuster only has 10 minutes of power.
Which is another classic Anno move. He loves to put mechs out there with limited amounts of power, because in his heart of hearts, what he always really wants to be making is Ultraman.
I've never seen Ultraman, I must admit.
Well, the thing about Ultraman is that he has what's called a color timer. So when Lieutenant Hayata activates the alien capsule and transforms into Ultraman, he only can be Ultraman for like 2 minutes, and then eventually the color timer, the red gem in the center of Ultraman's chest, will start flashing, and then if it runs out, I think he just reverts to his human form. But Ultraman is always operating with a very limited clock, and I think it is known that Anno imprinted on Ultraman hard. So
for me, it's also like, it's a good constraint.
Yeah, it's great.
Like, it never really gets old. It's always a really good source of suspense.
So Gunbuster has 10 minutes of power, and Noriko has to get out there and try and turn the tide of battle. And immediately, like, the superiority of Gunbuster compared with the weapons they've been using prior to this is like, it's overwhelmingly better. Like, she gets out there with the Buster Beam and like kills hundreds of them, but is struggling against the main ship, the mothership.
Yeah, because it's just, as we've seen from previous episodes,
they're incredibly fast.
They move in this fast blur, and that's what's happening. Yeah. Is she has way more self-possession, way more power than she did in her previous battles, but you still just can't hit this thing.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, and it's while she's
have to come explain this one.
And it's when her combat sequence starts that the opening theme of the show does in fact kick in. And you know, like,
I'm still gonna debate you on this.
Really? When is it then? No. I'm such an idiot. Now I get it.
I'll tell you.
No. I remember now. I'm such an idiot. I can't believe I fucked it up.
Because I made a note. The music in this part is rad, because there's this theme of Gunbuster.
No. I should have read my notes. Anyway, go on.
There's like an orchestral theme in Gunbuster that it's not the first time it's happened. I think that it played when Amano and Noriko and Young Freud first like went out into space.
Maybe, yeah.
And it's always good. It gets better every time, but the last time it happens, you are all gonna be fucked up.
Yes.
It's that like da 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 da.
Yes.
Da,
yeah.
Then okay, please explain what inertial canceller is.
I don't know. It's a nonsense phrase. I mean, I guess you can imagine that it is something that cancels inertia. Notionally, perhaps it is something that allows the much smaller. So the Gunbuster, despite its overwhelming size, is still much, much smaller than the enemy mothership they're just trying to engage.
It's like basically as big as the Excellion.
Yeah. And perhaps the inertial canceller is something that will allow it to, if it can get close enough, to actually slow this thing down.
Yeah.
So Noriko, like, is like inertial canceller full power, and what she has essentially decided to do, and the onlookers realized a moment before she does it, is to suicide this thing. She's going to just get in its way and let it run her through, and with whatever she has left, hopefully be able to destroy it.
And the space monster does just impale the Gunbuster.
Yeah, it's very sharp and pointy, and it just goes right through the middle. And how can you, like, the Gunbuster has been on screen maybe 5 minutes at this point. And it's like, remember the mech that this show is about? We are blowing it up. Like, we are ruining it 5 minutes after it shows up on screen, which I love. Such a baller move.
Yeah. But then
she has something left, and she, like, slams her fists into the nose of this thing, and, like, these crazy, like, sort of pylons pop out of the Gunbuster's arms and electrocute the thing.
And Noriko also has this amazing, just, like, 11th hour, like, rage scream.
Yeah.
When she does it. Like, this is not a Noriko that we've seen before.
No.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she destroys the space monster.
And there's a gigantic explosion.
And this is... It's very clear at this point, this is the only thing that could have destroyed the space monster.
Right.
Like, this would have been humanity's end.
Yes.
Pretty much, if she hadn't done this. Then,
No. Now it's my turn to correct you. Because there is a giant explosion. And it is not clear what is left after the explosion. And there's a line of dialogue that's like, you know, that, you know, the space monster has been eliminated, like, vaporized. What about the Gunbuster? Probably annihilated.
Yeah.
It's like, it's gone. But then there's like a line of like, no, look there. Then the opening theme cuts in, and then we see the silhouette of the battered but still entirely intact Gunbuster emerge from the smoke left behind from the explosion, and Noriko and the Gunbuster are both alive, and it's amazing.
And then Amano is overjoyed, and she flies up in her combat mech to the Gunbuster, and, like, Noriko, like, cradles her mech in the Gunbuster's hand, like,
yes.
King Kong.
Yes.
And this, to me, was the moment that was like, holy shit, the Gunbuster is so much bigger than anything else in the show.
It's a big, big boy.
And this is...
You love to see it. Folks, you absolutely love to see it when the opening theme of a show plays at the end.
Yeah.
You know that shit is going to get very real. And indeed, that's like, and the opening theme serves as the music for the closing credits.
Yeah. And the opening theme, you know, the visuals for the opening theme are mostly from episode one.
One and two, I think.
Where it's...
I've been meaning to point that out, actually. I love that they didn't have enough money or like time or budget to make like a dedicated opening animation sequence. There are only a couple of shots that show up in the OP and nowhere else. The rest of it is cut from footage from one episodes one and two. And this episode doesn't show the opening sequence at all, and it only plays the opening music during the end credits.
But it's still good how this song that we're used to seeing visuals of, like, for this show, relatively non-stressful days.
Yeah.
It really, like, slaps hard for this incredibly tense battle.
Yeah.
And I don't, like, this is just a genuinely inspiring moment.
Yeah, it's great.
And I think one of the reasons it's so good is that, to me, in this series of all six episodes, this is the only time that the show ends on that truly, like, action hype note.
Yes. And this is the only time that we've seen Noriko really come through since the end of the first episode.
Yeah,
she and has, the stakes she has, are... She has been struggling ever since then.
The stakes are much higher now. Yes. It's also, like, I don't really think that I've seen... Like, Amano has this, like, unbridled, like, sentimental joy, which is more vulnerability than we've seen from her.
Yes.
So that's also very... You love to see that too.
You absolutely love to see it.
And the visuals cut out at the silhouette of the Exelion and the Gunbuster floating in front of it. And even compared to the Exelion, the Gunbuster is enormous.
Yeah, like it's the Exelion is bigger, but it's like a spaceship carrying thousands of people with like its own transit system inside of it. Like the Gunbuster comes out of it and is like a visibly... It is, like, on the same scale.
That must have been a fucking big, like, launch door.
Yeah. Yeah, must have been. And then there's the next episode preview, which, in fact, is not a next episode preview. It's just a cute little super deformed cartoon of Noriko explaining that they couldn't do a preview because the episode isn't finished yet. Ha ha.
But they say, all we have is the titles.
All we have is the titles.
Which I do think it's a cool narrative move to like only give the titles. It's like when we're watching Terrace House and they have these really evocative titles that like often end up being lines of dialogue. And the whole time you're trying to figure out how this title factors in.
I see.
Also, the little like chibi Noriko.
Yes.
And the... It's like a is it like a PC? Like,
no, it's very obviously a Macintosh.
A Mac UI. Isn't that like what?
Yeah, it's
what's used for the like omake.
Yeah, it's the animation and background that's used for a series of little omake, like bonus, like shorts that. Explain like physics or world building or whatever for various parts of the Gunbuster universe that were like little bonus extras that we haven't been talking about. So they just used some of that animation, like they reused those animation assets to have like, and then recorded the voice actress being like, the episode's not done yet, but here are the titles. Just like classic on no, not being able to get those last couple of episodes done on time.
But still blowing it out of the water anyway.
Yeah, also that.
And a quick what Molly likes omake. If you have watched Hunter x Hunter 2011, the little ending sequences with Gon and Killua, I'm now wondering if they were inspired by the Gunbuster omake, because it's the same, like it's like the two characters kind of chibi doing almost like an academic explanation of something that happened.
Now that does sound very reminiscent.
I don't know, and I want to give people what we got in the preview. So the next two titles are Please, Time Enough for Love, and The End of Eternity, which are both really good episode titles for really fucking good episodes.
Yeah. And we'll be here to talk to y'all about them pretty soon, I expect.
Yeah.
Time dilation notwithstanding.
We will talk to you about them in 2032. Thank you all.